Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Pod and the Pendulum, the show that covers all the horror franchises, one movie and one episode at a time. As always, I'm your host, Mike Snoonian, and I'm not alone for this, our follow-up episode as we cover Paranormal Activity 2 from 2010. Sitting alongside me in the co-host chair today from the Spectre Cinema Club, and a man not afraid to get handsy-handsy as long as he has permission, Mr. Devon Taylor. Devon, how are we?
Hello. Consent is always great. Ready to talk too paranormal, too much activity?
Too fast, too paranormal. Tokyo Drift. Did I get that right?
Like, there is a Tokyo entry.
There absolutely is. Like, is that a both? I guess we'll chat about that in a minute. It's fascinating to me. I was looking for that this week because I think it used to be on YouTube, and I don't think it is anymore. But we are not alone. We have someone else haunting this house with us. As our special guest, you heard her on our Christmas episode, and we talked about all things Muppets. I think you're only going to join us for the Supernatural episodes, it sounds like. All the ghostly ones you will be on. She is a photographer and an artist that specializes in shibari rope bondage and nude portraits with an emphasis in body positivity. Let's welcome back Rachel Schwabach to the show. Rachel, how are we?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me back.
And did I get it right?
You did get it right. I'm so impressed. Because
you just told it to me. So I'm like, but I would still screw it up. And I had a quick question.
Yes.
Have you ever thought of starting a retro pod called like Way Back with Schwabach?
No, but that's a great idea. And I will give you 10%.
That's fantastic. I love it.
It's a generous share there.
It is. You know, that's about the age. The agent cuts usually what, like 2%?
Oh,
right.
Damn.
So 10 is I'm loving it. I'm absolutely loving that. Well, let's dive right in today. Let's get into this. And last week, Rachel, Devon and I kind of gave our own like personal history with this franchise and talked about, you know, when we first saw the movie and what we felt about the series as a whole. So I kind of want to turn it over to you for a moment and kind of find out, like, you know, when you first discovered the Paranormal Activity series, did it become like an instant favorite? Was it something that called out to you or something you fell in love with a little bit later on?
Well, I saw it in theaters because it was so hyped up that they were like, this is the scariest movie. And I'm like, coming off like Blair Witch from when you're younger, you're like, yes, I can't wait to see this. And then I fucking hated it. Like, I hated it so much. I think it's a terrible movie. And everyone in the theater was like going crazy. They loved it. And I was like, oh my God, this is just completely overrated.
And you're like, boo.
Truly, not even the slightest bit scary. I don't think I was scared once in the first one.
Wow.
But yet I've watched every single one of them because it's what you do.
So did that feeling carry over throughout this franchise? Like, is that the feeling you get?
Yes.
Interesting.
It never got better for you.
I think it gets better, but I think the main problems I have with it are that it's just never really scary.
Okay.
I'm like, I think it is interesting. And I think it's especially in the turn of technology in that time, like it is the first of its kind at that time when we had smartphones and we started having things that were letting us connect. But I just never found it scary.
Okay.
It's interesting.
So a couple questions then, because that's fascinating to me, because I found the first one in particular like pretty scary, and in part because it mirrors the structure of Blair Witch so much, except it takes place in like a tiny home as opposed to the woods with a bickering couple as opposed to three strangers. So it doesn't really mirror the structure of Blair Witch at all, I guess. But aside from that, What did you find so scary about Blair Witch that you found lacking in Paranormal Activity? Because that kind of is like a beat for beat.
For me, it is all the way in that they filmed Paranormal Activity.
Okay.
I think it could have been very scary, but the way they decide to show you intense scenes are so handed to you on a plate, like, hey, we're about to show you something scary.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, there was absolutely zero suspense.
Okay.
In the Blair Witch, yes, you're pulling the camera on when something's about to happen, but it didn't give me that same, okay, now you're going to see something scary that I felt in most of the Paranormal Activities that you're like, something's about to happen, and then it does, and you're like, okay.
Okay.
That's fascinating because I don't know if I've mentioned it on here, but or I didn't mention it last week, but I'm not a Blair Witch fan. I don't think Blair Witch Project is that good. I think it's a lot of people hold it highly because of the kind of cultural phenomenon it was. And like, especially like if you were around during that time, like I was only 6 when it came out. So I wasn't seeing Blair Witch in the theater. I didn't get the fervor. So it was like Blair Witch came to me a lot later. But also I watched it a couple of times. I watched it like, I guess a couple of years ago, most recently. And I was just like, yeah, this is all right. Like it's very fine. So I'm on the other end where, you know, and I didn't even think the first one of this is super scary, but I find it interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there you go, everybody. I am the Blair Witch hater.
So you would put it, if you were doing your found footage ranking, so it'd be Hell House 2, number 1, and then like number 37, Blair Witch Project is what you're saying.
Okay, I didn't like 2 that much. We've blown it out of proportion. How much I enjoyed Hell House 2.
That's what we do here. But
do I like Hell House LLC 2 more than Blair Witch Project? Maybe, probably.
Wow, that is. See, to me, Blair Witch is still the most terrified I think I've ever been in a theater.
Agreed.
It's that Gen Xer in me. Mm-hmm. I think, and that movie holds a spot. Go way, way back and listen to like the early Blair Witch episodes we did, and we have an interview with Eduardo Sanchez and Ben Rock, and you know, we did like 3.5 hours on just the Blair Witch Project, just the movie aside from those interviews. So it is still the most terrified I've ever been, and so I find that, but I can see why people don't think it's scary, and I think. To your point, Devon, like that movie did get hyped so much that like people that found it later were like, I don't get it. It's like 3 assholes walking around in the woods, like just being loud jerks, you know, like fuck them kids. So I can understand that part as well.
It's just such a time and a place for us before this. I didn't have access to the internet at that time. So I didn't know how to look if this was real or not. So for us at the time, it felt very different, and I think a lot of like that like nostalgia for things that you can't just find every answer for on the internet plays into that fear too.
Yeah. So my other question for you, Rachel, because what I also find fascinating is when we send out the call for guests and we, you know, I reached out and I'm like, hey Rachel, we get a bunch of like, here's the franchises we have coming up, would love to have you back on, had an absolute blast talking to you about the Muppets, what interests you? This is the one you picked. You're like, I'll do Paranormal Activity. We'd even have to ask. You're like, I'll do Paranormal Activity too. And you don't even like it. So what made you want it? Because usually people are like, let me talk about this movie that I love. And you're like, man, fuck these clowns. Like, what is it about this series that you don't like yet want to discuss and give us your Saturday afternoon over to? Because life is short.
Yeah, true. Sorry. Don't get me wrong. I love to talk about things I love, but I love making people talk about things I hate.
Okay.
I'm like, excellent. I love to rage discuss. So okay. I'm this excited to make people listen to me talk about how horrible I think it is.
Excellent. Well, this should be fun today.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to dive like quickly into the background of the movie here. There's not nearly as much on it as there is like the first movie. Like there was a quick turnaround on it, and it went from being like honestly a one person labor of love that is really fascinating to explore, like the rags to riches story, to like a movie by committee. Like a lot really, like once you get past the first movie, that is what most of these become. So the background sections will probably be much shorter in comparison to the first film. Very quickly though, we kind of mentioned it at the top of the start, can we really briefly mention Paranormal Activity, Tokyo Nights? And Devon, like you kind of made reference to it with like Too Fast, Too Tokyo Drift. What was that movie? Like, because that sequel actually comes out first, I think, in 2010, right?
Yes. Because what was the release date on this? Because they did these in October.
Tokyo, October, it must be Paranormal Activity.
Yes, not quite the same ring as Saw. Oh. But this one actually came out in November, so a month after So a month after the Paranormal Activity 2. But this one is called Paranormal Activity 2 Tokyo Night. So, which I find fascinating because I guess this is, it would be a sequel to the first, I guess. Instead of, but then that's funny that there wasn't a first Paranormal Activity Japanese version. But there's really not too much information that I could find about it. And it's, yeah, also not very readily available. But
it used to be on YouTube. I know that. It used to be on YouTube.
Gotcha. Well, it does take place, or it opens up in San Diego as these first two films take place in. But then it shifts back over into the main character, then goes back to Tokyo after this. But she, the main character, like gets in a car accident. So they're experiencing like all these paranormal activity stuff while in a wheelchair, which I think is an interesting, like, kind of added wrench to it, the kind of confinement as well. So I'm gonna keep searching as we do the series of the next couple weeks and see if I can find somewhere where we can watch it.
So my understanding is she gets in a car accident and ends up in a wheelchair after she hits Katie, after Katie is possessed and wanders out of the house immediately after the events of the first movie. Like, she hits Katie with her car. So after all of the first movie, like, so basically there's like a Toho Katie and a legendary Katie, much like Godzilla. So that is kind of what we have going on here. And then after that, like, if you read the synopsis, it pretty much remakes the first movie, except instead of being a couple, it's like the woman's brother caretaking for her. But yeah, it's set up after, like, the woman, like, hits and kills a possessed Katie with her car and gets in a crippling car accident. So it's just fascinating. And
I guess a little bit of Toby rubbed off on the car. Is that how she's going to get possessed for the next one?
It's like, you know, Herbie the love bug, but a demon type of deal, I guess. So, yeah. So it's I would like to find a way to watch this. I was looking for it ahead of, not that it would be like canon at this point, but it might be a fun bonus episode to just kind of do this. And it got high marks. I said it was like pretty well acted. The scares are really good. Some say it's actually better than like the official sequel, but you know, I haven't seen it, so who can say? If there's one thing like Japanese cinema does really well, like, they do great ghost stories, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, not like they don't have a long treasured history of like doing phenomenal supernatural cinema. So with this particular sequel, though, with the official sequel, unlike where, actually, like where Pelly made it, it's a personal challenge where it's at his own pace. There's no pressure for him. You know, he's like, well, if it sucks, no one has to see it. Now you've got like the heavy burden of like success of the first movie, the fear of a sophomore slump. And now there's like too many cooks in the kitchen. So, you know, to quote our good friends, Lars von Trier, like, chaos reigns when it comes to making the sequel here. If Blair Witch Project was the guiding force behind the first movie, the stench of Blair Witch Project Book of Shadows was kind of the worry that hung over the production of part two.
I don't know what stench you're talking about. Book of Shadows rules.
I love Book of Shadows.
All right, it's been a great show. We had a good run. 230 episodes. I hate that. Probably the first movie that's ever made me angry in a theater. Like, visibly angry. Oh God, I hate that movie so much. Moving on. I'm just gonna take a deep breath and just move on. With this, like, Kevin Kruter, who directed Saw 6, was originally slated to direct Paranormal Activity 2, but Michael R. Perry was set to write. But, you know, Lionsgate decided to pull some shenanigans. Like, I mean, they were feeling a bit upset and a bit worried. I mean, obviously, Paranormal Activity came out and really cut into the success of Saw and Saw 6, despite probably, I think it was the top rated movie in our polls. I think when we did our Saw rankings, that is what, if it didn't come out on top, it came out like in the top two or three in terms of our overall franchise rankings. Lionsgate pulled the sequel card and basically said you're contractually obligated to come back and direct Saw 7. So Gritaire wasn't able to move on to do Paranormal Activity 2. Oren Peli, who wrote and directed the first film, he was only involved with the sequel as a producer. He was moving on to start writing and directing Area 51. And also, like, he's not a filmmaker. I mean, like, you know, I think, Rachel, to your point, like, when you talk about how rewatching these movies, like watching this one back to back with the first, I'm like, this is a better made film overall. Like, it's I like the first one more, but this is a better made movie. Like, Peli's not necessarily a filmmaker. So all of this is done. Twisted Pictures and Lion Gates use that clause. Gritaire's back on Saw 3D, and they're 2 weeks away from filming. They start considering people they can bring in, and one of the people they consider is your boy Devon, Mr. Alfred Hitchcock Jr. himself, Brian De Palma. Do you think of that?
I mean, that could have been wild, because Brian De Palma, he does love his layers of meta filmmaking. He often opens his movies in other movies, in a TV show, in a music video. So I think his take on found footage could have been super interesting. I know by this point he had kind of slowed down a little bit. He hadn't stopped making movies, but he had drastically slowed down around this point. But this could have been a nice little comeback for him. Or if he did direct it, and obviously these movies make a lot of money, he could have gotten a paycheck to do something weird afterwards. So would have been nice. I think, again, I think Brian De Palma could have made a super rad found footage film. But, you know, what could have been?
Think of the voyeurism angle, because these movies are so much about their surveillance state. And think of what De Palma could have done with that. And just consider that for a moment. And I don't know how seriously they considered it, but it was one of those things where, like, that name was thrown out there. Think of the memes. Like, think of, like, Nick Cage in 8mm watching footage of Paranormal Activity 2. Just think of the memes we could have gotten. And we were deprived of them. We were deprived.
I love how it was between De Palma and Akiva Goldsman. That's like choosing between, hey, do you want a champagne or do you want a flat soda water? You know,
but some people would choose that flat soda water. Some people would be like, give me that thing with no taste. Some people love, you know, the other day I brought home vanilla ice cream. My daughter wanted ice cream and I brought home, I just wanted vanilla. And she got so mad at me. She's like, why did you buy vanilla? I'm like, well, you're eating it. And she's like, well, it's still ice cream. But she was so mad. She ate it with such a scowl. Like, she could have just murdered me. She wanted dinosaur crunch. Anyway, March 2010, Todd Williams is tapped to direct the film. And production's going to begin that way. Wow. May shoot date comes out in October. What could go wrong? And kind of like taking a look, like the only other movie he's done of note is Cell, which is an adaptation of a Stephen King novel. It's not good. Like, the book isn't really good. Like, it starts great and then really tapers off. In the movie, despite starring John Cusack, it's not a good movie.
No.
We'll move on from that. So production begins without a completed script. Like, they have this idea, like, hey, the first movie, we're just going to do retro scripting. We'll give you ideas for a scene and we'll see what we come up with. Like, that worked in the first movie. Let's do that here. And about 3 weeks into the filming, the footage is said to be disastrous. Like, what they're getting back is not scary. It's not cohesive. It doesn't look fun. So that leads to, like, a writer's room being assembled and production shutting down for a short time. And Christopher Landon is one of the writers that is brought in to give notes on the footage, which prompts the studio to hire him as an executive. And we'll talk more about Landon, I think, as we go further along in this series, because from this point on, he's going to be the person that, like, takes over for Peli and really spearheads and shepherds the direction that the series goes in. Like, the remaining Paranormal Activity movies are kind of his baby. And of course, he would go on to do things like Happy Death Day, Freaky, And more recently, he would get removed from Scream 7 after a lot of acrimony behind the scenes. But he just got like a big, I'm trying to think, he just landed a massive project. And it sounds awesome.
And I forget which one it is, but it is he basically saved this franchise. And it was saved this film, thus saving the franchise. So it kind of makes sense. And they can't really do the retro scripting like they did in the first one, because the first one only has two people in the movie. Well, a couple cameos by those doctors, but like for the most part, it's just the two of them. So it's like, that's a little bit easier. This one has more characters and things like that. And it's just like, it's going to be chaos if you're going to try and do it the way that they did the first one. Like this one, had to be kind of more written traditionally.
No. I'm trying to think what Christopher Landon, he's talking about like a werewolf movie. I don't know. I like Christopher Landon. He'll land on his feet. Dude has done some pretty rad stuff.
That was a good one.
Anyway, what?
Land on his feet?
Oh, Jesus. I'll cut that out. That was a bad pun.
No, that was... Loved it.
Well, this is what Landon has to say about like the writer's room at the time. He basically talks about the early footage and being a disaster. Says, I'm in this room and all the writers are saying, this is great. The head of the studio looked at me, the frown on my face, and said, what's wrong? I said, this isn't good. This doesn't work. I think you guys are in trouble. And it's not scary. You need to have moments. And I pitched in the room the scene that's later in Paranormal Activity 2, where Christy gets ripped out of the nursery and pulled down the stairs into the basement. So he says he came up with that on the spot. And again, it's like one man's version of what's going on at the time. So I don't necessarily know like what really happened. No one else really talks about the early footage, and you can't really find any of the test footage anywhere, but it sounds like they trusted him enough to say, okay, we really trust where you're going with this. And he would take over from there. So, and this is where Landon kind of gets like his really big break. Michael Perry comes on board. He's written and produced a lot of TV. Tom Paps, who's done some TV. They're going to just script this now more like a traditional movie. And it's something that Featherstone had talked about, like after comparing the first two movies, saying in the first movie, she had a lot of freedom to come up with ideas. And then after that, it became much more of a make sure you hit your mark, make sure you get your line type of process. Teaser comes out with the Twilight Saga Eclipse on June 30th. Like, wow, again, starting shooting in May and then June 30th, you've got a teaser out with Twilight. That's wild. Cinemark pulls the trailer from several Texas theater after receiving complaints that it's too frightening, which, okay, Texas. The film is released in the United States on October 22nd, 2010. It's made available in the IMAX format as well as a standard, because if anything is screaming out for the IMAX format, it is these security camera found footage movies. Like that again, I think Christopher Nolan made it a point to drive around every IMAX theater and smash every print that was playing in an IMAX cinema, saying this is not cinema. And then he was like escorted out of the theaters and told not to return. I mean, that's just what I've heard.
I mean, this came out the same year as Inception. So I imagine Nolan getting told, hey, we're going to take your movie out of IMAX because we got Paranormal Activity 2 coming up.
Can you even imagine? Can you?
Oh, God.
That would be amazing. What breaks the record for the biggest midnight gross for an R-rated film with like $6.3 million? Beating the record held by Zack Snyder and Watchmen for $4.6 million. And Zack Snyder decides, I just need a Batman that kills after that. That'll bring the kids back and I'll get that record again. And it breaks the record for the biggest opening for a horror movie of all time at the time. On opening day, Paranormal Activity 2 places number one at the box office, makes over $20 million. So again, movie that's like a couple million to make at this point, already extremely profitable, and finishes with $41 million in the first weekend, making it number one at the box office. At the US, it does just under $85 million during its run, and it makes almost $93 million overseas. So these like very, very little movies, couple million to make, are now making like Marvel money. At the time, it's like $177 million at the box office. Plus you're pulling in like millions more once you're getting to DVD and Blu-ray a few months later. So if you're Paramount and you're a Blumhouse, you are very, very happy with this, right?
Oh yeah, they're making lots of money. The reception wasn't as good as the first one. No. Did make similar money, but the Rotten Tomatoes for this one, 58% compared to the 83% of the original. It was kind of like going through, and the consensus it pretty much seemed was like, yeah, this is it. Still has some scares, but it's not really, it's not reinventing the wheel or anything. It's not breaking any new ground, which I'll agree with, because I think this one, even more so than the first one, feels more like a classic haunted house film. So I can kind of see that, but people were still like, okay, it's still scary, it's not completely. Like, nobody was saying that the sequel is like unnecessary or anything, which I find, very interesting, considering the first one wasn't meant to be, a franchise. It was meant to be just standalone. So it didn't like get at least the pushback of it being a sequel.
I would agree. I remember seeing this in theaters and thinking it was a letdown, because I really loved the first one. And at the time, feeling like it was a bit of a letdown. Although, like, rewatching them now back to back and rewatching the series like a year ago, like running through the series or the first four movies, thinking like, actually, this one holds up, I think, much stronger over time. But I think back in 2010, feeling like it felt like more of the same. So I guess we'll move on to our movie discussion, and maybe that's where we start. And Rachel, as our guest and as the person who doesn't love these movies, what did you think, like, walking out of the theater in 2010, when you like see that it's kind of continuing the Katie story, which you didn't like the first time around? Did you feel like, all right, that gives me a fuller understanding and maybe makes it feel a little better? Or you're like, man, I just got fucking suckered again. What did you feel walking out of that crisp Halloween season evening back in 2010?
I liked it because I hated the first one so much. I think that I was far more satisfied walking out of the second one. Mm-hmm. Some of that can be production quality, but I think especially the way it's laid out with the first one, having a few more what I consider actual scary things happen compared to the first one, where does anything scary actually happen? So to me, I was way more excited about it. I still hated it, but hated it less.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think it's a better, definitely a better movie, more enjoyable. Even watching them through now, I'm like, God, I would take this over the first one any day.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
And what do we feel about this idea of making this like a prequel, or like kind of more of a prequel, very little sequel, kind of running parallel?
Yeah,
to the events of the first movie. What are our thoughts on that?
Yeah, I really like it. Like, that's like the structure of this franchise, again, is kind of one of the more interesting elements to it, the way we're kind 100%. Of going back and forth. This is prequel sidequel. So the first movie takes place between mid September and October 2006. This one starts off August 7th, 2006. So it's a little bit before, and then we do catch up to, obviously Katie killing Mika and then coming back later. And I think it even goes a smidge earlier than that too, because like we kind of see the first home video footage, like Hunter's like a baby, and then it like kind of cuts, and then he like has hair and is walking. So like, I think even that first scene takes place, I guess, would have been like maybe June or July or something like that, a little bit beforehand, or maybe earlier than that.
Way earlier than that.
Oh yeah, because crawling. December. Yeah, because it was crawling. So it would have been, but because since it didn't have the security footage, we didn't get the timestamp for those like earlier scenes. But I think it is really cool. I remember like the first time watching you know, whenever I was like going through the, you know, franchise, like for the first time. And then like, you know, whenever Katie, you know, knocks on the door and you're just like, oh shit, it's Katie. Like, what's going on here? And, you know, I'd say up until Ghost Dimension, this might've been a lot of people's least favorite. I've seen this one kind of crop up on the lower end of a lot of people's lists. And I mean, I think it's solid. I think it's different. It does offer, I think it does offer some better scares. But I do think that Mika and Katie being able to focus on them in the first one made their relationship a little bit more interesting. Mm-hmm. So I did like that Katie is still around and she's, you know, going to be around for another movie as well. So I think it's really cool.
No, you first, Rachel.
I was going to say, I just think it added a lot of tension that I feel like is lacking from these movies to be like, here's Katie. Even with telling you the dates, I feel like I'm not remembering that in my first watch through. I'm like, well, is she okay? Why is she here? Last time I saw her, she was wandering off after murdering her boyfriend. So you're like, gives that will she, won't she, is she going to just like snap a baby's neck out of nowhere kind of vibe where you don't know. And I feel like it added a lot to the movie that made it more interesting watching her develop through the second, even though her role is pretty small.
Yeah. So do you think watching this gives like more context to like Rachel and Mika's relationship or more insight into it? Is that something we're even interested in, or is it kind of just neat that those two show back up and we recognize them?
Go ahead, Rachel.
I was just going to say, I feel like it was a small redemption for Mika, because in the first movie, I feel like hands down, he's insufferable. There's mm-hmm. never a part that I like him. But seeing him pop up at like brunch that one morning and like being around, he loves his nieces and nephews. He seems to be a real person in the second one in a way that I didn't feel like he sure. was in the first one. So for me, I enjoyed that delving deeper.
I don't think it like gave, yeah, like any new context, but it was like, definitely seeing it in a different light. The brunch scene is cute, I'll say though, but like whenever him and Dan are talking in the pool together is one of the most insufferable exchanges like ever. I was just like, these two, I was like, of course, like, you know, like, you know, that the sisters would both end up with shitty men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, because I remember, because there's a like scene earlier where it's just Katie and then they ask where Mika is, and then they like say, oh yeah, no, he's away on something. So like you like are like, oh, like they got Katie back but didn't get Mika back, that's kind of weird. So it was like just him popping up again, like it just like made the world feel more fleshed out.
I like how he's going to different Burger Kings trying to like scam free meals because he knows like the owner, and they're like dude, I don't own every Burger King, like I'm not the CEO. So I kind of like that about Mika, that you know, he's this like tech bro that'll spend like $5,000 on like a Red camera to film, you know, his girlfriend getting haunted, but he doesn't want to pony up for like the value menu at BK. Like that kind of tickled me when that scene comes up later on. So here's what I wonder, what do we just think of the decision to kind of continue the story of Katie and Mika and Hunter, and like make this movie and the next movie and the next movie all about this family? Because I think that this is like, the first movie is such a great standalone story. Like it's nice, it's one and done, and you can stop it there. And if you want to do a sequel, there are a million different directions that this series could go in. And this is where the mythology really builds out. Like it's not the first movie. The first movie that you really don't hear a lot about Katie's family, you get like one or two little nuggets, but they're just kind of dropped in for a little bit of world building. They don't necessarily feel like they're put in there because they're looking at a sequel. In fact, if you got the original endings, Katie dies in all of the original endings. She's either murdered by the police or she slits her own throat. You know, it's not until they do the theatrical ending after Spielberg suggests keep her alive that, you know, you open up the possibility. And if you went with the Japanese ending, she would have been killed by a Honda. So it's just, it is one of those things where
I mean,
you could have just ended this thing and gone in another direction. How do you feel about this movie building this whole world and basing like four or five movies at least around it?
I have more of your complaint when it comes to four, which I'm not sure if I'm going to be on for that episode, but I'll just go ahead and say that, like, that's where I'm like, okay, the first three, like, that's a nice trilogy connecting the family. You go back and forth, you do the prequel, and then four, we think we're getting a fresh spin, and then it's like, oh no, it's still the, you know, stuff going on. So I have more of a complaint for that, for four. For this one, I find it quite impressive, honestly, like on how much they were able to build, like you said, just off of those little small references in the first one. The first one, all we know is that Katie has a sister. We hear that they don't like their grandma, and that Katie and Christy had paranormal stuff in their past as kids. That's literally about all you get. So I do like how much they were willing or able to do, especially with even like small details. Like in the first one, you know, Katie finds the singed photo in the attic, you know, and it's like, oh, how'd that get there? And it's like, you know, scary. But then we get the answer to that in two. And I even thought that was like a like fun, like, oh, like that was a nice way to like kind of loop this back in. I mean, I personally, I like that we're kind of exploring this family, you know, that seems, you know, on the surface, quote unquote, normal and regular, like kind of your average family, like especially in this one compared to the first one, like as this is like they got the all-American family. They got the dog. They got the live-in nanny. They got the kids, you know, and it's like kind of like, you know, very average family. But then as you like kind of dig deeper into, you know, the past of this family, I find it fascinating. So yeah, no lore complaints from me in this one.
Agreed. I think it's a great way to develop the story more. I don't know that it would have been as interesting to just switch to another haunting, unless maybe they really knocked it out of the park with scary stuff. But I feel like it was a surprising natural progression. Mm-hmm. I didn't see it coming the first time I watched it. I remember being like, oh, and
yeah,
here for it.
I definitely agree with you, Devon. Four is when I tapped out, because four seems like a rehash of two in a lot of ways, like even to the degree that you're like following it from the point of view of like the teenage girl in the movie. And it just feels like a rehash of that movie. You're trying to like capture the baby or the young boy in that one. And that's where I like tapped out at the end of it. And I haven't watched the two that follow it to this point. And at the time, especially that I didn't really love or really enjoy this movie that much, four felt like the weaker version of it. So like, why am I going to keep watching? And that seems like the jumping off point for a lot of people. Like you watch, you see where it went after four and how many people were like, I think I'm good. I think I can cut it from here. We're okay. We've had enough of this. What's going over on in Insidious and Conjuring Land at this point? We'll go start watching those movies. So, I don't know. Like, I think maybe that's why I like the seventh one so much, is because it's such a good standalone movie. I can't wait to talk about that last movie when we get to it. The one that was like only on streaming only.
That's the only one I haven't seen.
Yeah, which one is that?
Next of Kin
takes place in an Amish type of commune, and it's really good.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah,
okay.
It's good. It's different. It's a lot different. So it's pretty cool. I really enjoyed it when it came out. So you'll see if it holds up on rewatch. But with this family, do you feel that there's more of an attempt this time to make them feel like, and I think you kind of hinted at that, Devon, it does feel that they're more cohesive than what we saw with like Mika and Katie, because I think I said on the first episode, Paranormal Activity feels like Kramer versus Kramer, with like the demon and Mika fighting over Katie. Like it is just a bad relationship from the very start. And at no point do you feel like Katie and Mika should be together. I mean, Daniel's a shit heel, but there are at least moments when this family feels a bit cohesive, right?
I mean, I think it's just different. I wouldn't even say more cohesive, because, you know, I think whenever I watch the first one, I'm like, I don't be like, oh, Katie and Miko shouldn't be together. It's just like, oh, they just moved in together and their relationship is like changed in form. So like, you know, we don't know what their dating life was prior to getting a house together. They probably were super happy, you know, so it's like, and this one, it is, yeah, again, like, it's like kind of, they put a lot more emphasis on this kind of, you know, the nuclear family falling apart, you know, like, you know, being torn apart from the inside, which is fascinating because on one hand, like on the surface, they look like a, you know, family, but then like, we do get like the details. It's like, oh, Allie is from Dan's previous marriage and like things like that. You know, so, in which a random side complaint, I really hate it when, like siblings like put so much emphasis on being half siblings. Like whenever she's like, oh, you're my brother from another mother. And it's like, I don't know, that always annoys me. Cause I have seven siblings and they're all halves, but like, I don't like call them that. I always think that's just like, so very weird to me. I'm like, you know, siblings is siblings. So like they are, you know, mostly a traditional family aside from, you know, he has, you know, a kid from a previous marriage, but I mean, I like them as a unit. I really like Allie. I think Allie is the best character in this. I kind of forgot that, you know, it focuses a lot more on her than it does on Christy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I like the difference in it. But I wouldn't say that like they are, you know, more cohesive because they have their own issues as well, you know?
Well, they do. But I think when we watched that first movie, throughout the first movie, like Mika is basically psychologically abusive to Katie throughout the whole movie. Like there are like almost no instances where he shows her any sort of kindness whatsoever. He completely minimizes all the fear. We talked about this for 3 hours last week, so I don't want to rehash the whole first movie, but I don't think anyone came down on Team Mika. I think we are all pretty much like, fuck that guy. Here there's like a little bit, like Christy and Daniel at least have moments in those first 20 minutes where they seem to actually like one another, right? Am I wrong?
I don't really see it like, yeah. Dan is that dad that he goes around has to remind people that he bought the things or that he owns the stuff, and he has, we get introduced to that. We get introduced to him. He has two man caves. Like, okay.
Yes, that
like,
is a thing. Like, that is a bad thing.
So like, you know, and like, yeah, like, I mean, I guess that he's nice to Christy. Like, oh, I mean, if we're going to give out a husband participation award, like, yeah, you should be nice to your husband, but I'm not going to give him any credit. I don't think he's like, you know, like, no.
But I mean this from the perspective of like, you see them joking with one another. You see them, like, she's like, well, I kind of want to get you in the tub and smash me. And they're like being a little bit playful with one another. You don't have really any of those moments in the first movie. I think Dan is a dick. And I think Dan doesn't really know how to interact with other human beings. And we'll talk about the dickiness of Dan. But I don't walk into this movie, like at least for the first 20 minutes, it does a good job of masking all the problems you're going to see in the last hour and 10 minutes. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
I feel like they made Dan exactly like Micah, but they had the ability to make his assholeness insidious. He hides it behind his joking. He hides it behind his da da da, like his little damn personality. So he's still being a dick. I feel like even when there's the baby, he is still, he's not really helping her. He's like, gotta go to work. You've gotta do this.
He hold the baby the entire movie?
Never.
They made it more subtle that he's a raging asshole because Mika, they hid nothing, but I feel like they tried to make it a little less obvious. So even in the beginning, I think you still see him as kind of a controlling, that overbearing, like any joke he makes is kind of mean. Anything he says is a little dig. So it's much more subtle, but I think in the same way, he's exactly the same asshole. He can just hide it better. Yeah.
I would say, like, you pointed out the two man caves, like, number one, never, ever use the phrase like man cave. Like, that is such a gross and disgusting term. And then he's like, this is my giant TV. And so I used to work in AV. I think I've mentioned that before. And I'm looking at that and I'm like, eh, that's not that big of a TV. I'm like,
I've seen bigger, Dan.
Like, that's the kind of size you tell people that, like, oh yeah, that's big. You know, that's a good size. It's all right. It's just right. But no, there's bigger.
Any bigger, it would look weird on that wall, you know?
Yeah, exactly. What are you covering for, Dan?
Well, he's covering that he's a Chargers fan. That's why he's such an asshole.
True. But there's also this thing, too. Like, we talked about, like, the wealth of the first movie, or, like, the consumption in the first movie. Like, Mika kind of lives the lifestyle of someone who really wants to be rich. Like, he's buying a lot of consumer goods that are not quite top end, but, like, are still pretty expensive, and he's filling his home with them. Like, Katie even makes it a point, like we mentioned in the first movie, I think it was Mary Beth or Jess who said, you know, Katie has just like one little workbench where she keeps all her beating. And it comes up in this movie. Katie's like, I have one fucking bench in this whole house. And Mika's whole personality has taken over the rest of it. Mika lives like he wants to be rich, and Dan has actual fuck you, I'm rich money. Like, this is ostentatious levels of wealth that we see in this movie here. Like, it is insane.
And the house, it's like, I mean, obviously the first one's a little bit bare bones just because it was Oren Peli's house. But like this one, it feels, you know, more fleshed out. It feels lived in. It feels like a family lives here. Which is interesting. And yeah, but like Dan, like, kind of has like the slight veneer is there, you know, like, you even, you know, whenever he's like talking to Allie and she says my bathroom, he's like, well, it's actually my bathroom, I paid for it. It's like, bro, we get it. You know, so like, you know, kind of moments like that. And which, again, like it, you know, is a very stark difference between the two couples. Like, one of them is a, you know, couple that is, you know, just kind of moving up, you know, versus, you know, like, obviously, Chris and Dan, they're already married, they've already been living together, and now they have, you know, this kid. So it's like they're, you know, on different levels. I can't remember between Katie and Christy who's older and who's the younger one.
Katie. It's Katie.
Katie is the older one. Oh, well, that's fascinating then, because usually you would think it's like the older one, older sister would have kind of had it together a little bit quicker. But and there's also a smidge of an age difference as well, because like at the time of filming this, Christy's actor was like only in her like late 20s, and Dan, as you know, gray in his beard, he's clearly a bit older. So I don't know if that has anything to do with, you know, the kind of portrayal of this as well. But yeah, it's just different.
It is. You mentioned your like of Allie, and I think I put here, like, she's the low key MVP of this movie. I got, like, even with like the interactions with her boyfriend, who, you know, is not here a lot in the movie, but he's not too much of a distraction. I got like Nancy and Glenn vibes from A Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, she's actually figuring stuff out, and he's trying to help her, but he's also kind of a doofus, but not in like the worst way possible. What is it that we like about Allie in this movie?
I mean, she just, she's just easy to relate to. Like, I mean, like, you know, she's, I like that she's not the, you know, kind of the horror teen where she's like, you know, snobby and like has an attitude all the time or like anything like that. Like, she's just a, you know, normal teenager. She's, you know, she hangs out and she does stuff. She helps the family out when they need to, but then she also has a boyfriend and wants to do things like that. She just feels like a very, you know, like, nice teenager. Like, you know, like, I'd hang out with Allie. You know, and I forgot to ask, like, a little bit earlier, did you guys watch the unrated extended cut?
That, yes,
the extra both. Footage.
Okay. I watch both,
because that's like kind of also what I noticed in like kind of the differences between the two of them. A lot you know, a lot of Allie scenes are extended in the unrated cut. Where we, like, you know, get more in her head and, you know, like, you know, her trying to figure this out. So, yeah, I really like that, you know, and it changes over time, too. Like, in the first half, in the first, like, 30 minutes, like, she's around, but she's not, like, you know, being focused on all that much. But as the film goes over, she, you know, then takes over and becomes, you know, the main character, final girl.
And she's the only one who seems to actually do anything about it. Like, I understand Christy's possessed, so, like, can't be too mad at her. But you're like, come on. Like, all this shit is happening, and no one's even Googling it. Like, no one's looking at anything. I feel like she's the only one who's like, do you guys not see this?
She's the only one, like, looking back at the camera footage. It's like, they have all these cameras and stuff. Dan, like, will never, like, go back and look at the footage. And it's like, well, what did you get the cameras for? So you can see the things that are happening. And Allie's
the
only
rich guy
that, like, is willing to do that.
Yeah. And she's nice to everybody. She's nice to Martine. That's what I'm like, you got the only one who's really nice to Martine. She's good to the dog. She's good to her brother. She's good to everyone. She's actually emotionally developed as a character, whereas Dan isn't. And she's just a badass for being 14 or 15. Yeah.
So I think when I put, they try to make them seem more cohesive, we were putting our focus in Dan and how he interacts with. But I think the focus, what I mean by that, is more how Allie and Christy relate to one another. Because what this film, I think to its credit, what it never does is it never plays on the wicked stepmother, stepdaughter relationship, which, given that like the stepmother is who gets possessed in this movie, it would have been really easy to go that route. You can see a lesser version of this where like a possessed Christy is increasingly crueler and meaner and more abusive towards Allie, but like Dan is too blind to see it because he's lost in work and too many other things. But what you see is Allie actually goes out of her way to check on Christy to make sure that she's okay, to like listen to her and to like acknowledge that what Christy is going through is real, which shows a tremendous amount of emotional maturity at like age 14, 15, 16 years old. Like, I'm not sure how old she's supposed to be in this movie. You said 14, Devon. Like, is that, I was maybe a little bit older.
I mean,
high school.
We never get like mentions of her driving.
Yeah.
So I'd assume 15 at the oldest then.
Because there's probably that deleted scene where she's in the hot tub with her boyfriend at 1 a.m. And like the dad in me is like, okay, no, if you're 14, like your boyfriend can come over and chill and hang out, but not at 1 and not in a hot tub. 11 p.m. You got to go home, my friend.
That scene has my favorite, my biggest laugh though of the entire movie, because the Dan's like, are you serious, Brad? What are you doing? And Brad goes, I'm not even here.
It's like Brad is the ghost all along. He outs himself as the ghost.
But I agree though, that it would have been easy to go the evil stepmom route. And I like how it's even like kind of pointed out, because then later, Katie is like, ooh, I'm the wicked step.
Yes.
You know, which is kind of, oh, hey, keep an eye out for Katie later on in the movie.
It's an ironic line where she's like, I'm the evil step. I'm not, but I can be. But also like Christy comforts Allie, and she makes it a point to say I love you to her, and then later they talk to one another, like when Dan is like, I'm tired of this haunted house crap, I don't want to hear it enough, like this is bullshit, the two women are like, well, enough of that guy, and like they just sit there and they talk to one another. And I think that's what I mean by this movie being like showing a more cohesive unit. It's not just about like Dan. It's also like the mom and the stepdaughter, the mom and the daughter really working together, and Allie wanting to take care of her younger brother as well.
That's another trope that I like they didn't play into, is the like teenager who doesn't give a fuck about their little sibling while they're taking care of them. They leave the house. No, she was there taking care of him. She was upset when she got locked out. They don't go to that. And I also think, oh, sorry, I knocked my headphone out. I got excited. Okay. That she checks on Christy, even when Christy's like, no, everything's fine. She's like, no, it's not. Like, she knows her stepmom more than what she's just saying. She's like, did something happen? Because I can tell you're scared. So that, again, the emotional intelligence, the subtlety.
Yeah. The one thing I don't buy before we move on to Christy, because I do want to move to her since you just mentioned her, I don't know if I buy her listening to the Ramones and Misfits. Like when I see the Ramones poster on the wall and the Misfits Fiend Club, I could see if this is made in 2024, her wearing a Ramones t-shirt or a Misfits t-shirt. Like you see kids wearing those all the time. But I don't think kids did that back then without listening to the bands. Do you know what I mean? Like that wasn't a thing in 2010.
I don't know. Hot Topic existed, so a lot of people had a lot of posters that they didn't know shit about.
I mean, she could have. I mean, hell, most of my favorite music's from the 70s. So, like, you know, I'll give her credit. She might be a Ramones fan.
She does strike me as more of like a My Chemical Romance kind of girl, maybe.
Yeah. I don't think she's going back. I did not. I think that was the
Ramones, yes. Misfits.
You think so?
I feel like the Ramones are the first, like, easy punk band shown to anyone. Mm-hmm. It's like the most societally palatable. So I feel like it was the first one anyone was given. My like nephews play it in School of Rock, which is like music class.
I can also totally see Dan being the type of person he like hears her listen to My Chemical Romance and goes, "Oh no, here, let me show you real music, what I was listening to when I was in high school," and like introduce her to the Ramones and Misfits.
So now I feel attacked when you just said that, Devon, because I've definitely done that. I've definitely played
Oh, so
tracks
that's
for
why
my
you're
children.
defending Dan in this
No,
episode.
I mean, I think it's okay to expose your children to your taste in music, and they will either
No.
mock and scorn you for it, or they will, like my daughter rocks a Jawbreaker tote bag and is, we're going to see Bikini Kill in September together, and that's okay.
Now, I don't think Dan is cool enough to listen to the
No,
Misfits.
I
I'm like, I'm
don't.
gonna say Allie's more likely to than Dan.
Right.
Like,
All right. I just that was the one thing where I could just see a production designer being like, I'm putting a Ramones and Fiend Club poster up and
fine.
just kind of like slipping by. I don't know. But that was my pet peeve. I will admit, like, I definitely have a bugaboo about that where like I'll see kids at my school wearing like a Nirvana shirt and being like, name three Nirvana songs and I'll order you pizza today. And no one has been able to do it yet. And I'm like, oh, come on, kids. Okay. Moving on, Christy. Fascinating character to me because it feels to me it's a lot harder to get a handle on her as a character than it is Katie. She feels like she has more agency, but then she doesn't. Like it feels like she's a kept woman. Like it feels like she's, when you watch this movie, and a lot of it is just the way this is filmed. It almost feels like she's been imprisoned in this home at times. And I'm wondering what your all take is on her as a character.
I mean, I don't, she's not as interesting as Katie, nor as well performed as Katie. I mean, even when Katie pops up in this, I'm like, I kind of zone in on her a little bit more. And I think I don't know if that's any fault to the movie that they just were kind of being like, oh, we're still gonna have Christy, but we're not gonna have her be the sole focus. Because I would have liked to have spent a little more time with her. I feel like I didn't really get to know her. I don't know anything about her or, kind of what she does or anything. And like, then she's just, she ha they kind of do the, oh, she's the, the tired mom with the new baby that like can't leave. But that only, that doesn't happen until after Martine is fired, because before that, they have Martine there to like, do the things for them. So I don't know. I would have liked to have kind of gotten a little bit more with Christy. I think the most interesting scenes that we get of Christy is when she's with Katie, and we kind of get to know their relationship a little bit more. But like, I just don't really, unfortunately, just kind of don't really get as much of that from Christy in this one. And she is, I don't want to say a prop, but I mean, she's really there to be the one that gets possessed, in the second half of the movie. Like, she's just kind of there. She has a few, she does have a few, really good scenes. Some of, her reaction scenes to some of the scares are pretty good. But yeah, I would have liked to have gotten to know her a little bit in this.
I feel like they kind of place her as that almost in all of them and in all of her relationships. Like, at least in the first one, Katie has a friend over. Katie talks about her beating. With Christy, they don't even give you that. They're never like, your old friend, this, someone called for you. You know nothing about her passions, anything. She is just a caregiver to her baby. She is a prop, and they don't develop her. And the way Katie talks to her too, she's like, we don't talk about this. She is very like subservient, both to Dan, both to Katie. In the end, kind of to the demon. And I feel like that is her whole personality. And maybe I think some of that stems from kind of how it is in the third, where you see her as a kid, that you're like, she has just been told and pushed here and there that she has nothing of her own. And she just does what is told of her or expected of her. And she doesn't have personality for us to know.
The scene with Katie is fascinating, and I'm glad you brought that up because I think a couple things are fascinating there. You see a lot of Mika come out of Katie in that scene, and you see a lot of like how Mika talked to Katie throughout the first movie, like You don't talk about this. This is freaking me out. You are making other people scared with your behavior, which is something that Mika said to Katie throughout the first movie. Babe, you're freaking me out. When Katie would be like shaking and convulsing on the ground, crying because she's so terrified. And then she would have to put that aside in order to manage her giant man baby's feelings because he was scared and not able to give comfort. You're watching that come out of Katie. And the way she talks to him, her Katie, her sister, Christy, at that point, she's like, we don't talk about it. You push it down. You're going to end up like mom. Do you understand? Like really forceful, really commandeering and dominant. And you hear like Christy, you don't see her, but you hear her voice kind of retreat in that moment. Like, sure, sure. So poor Christy, to your point, both of you said, like, she doesn't really have anyone. Like, no one comes to call on her. The only people you see her interact with are the members of her family. She doesn't have anybody that she can turn to and really process the stuff that she's going through with. She has to keep it all internal. She even says to Daniel at one point, I hate when you don't take me seriously. Like after the pool prank, she outright like makes the subtext text, like, you don't take me serious. She's treated pretty poorly. And he's telling her just like, I want my fun wife back. I want you to put on the little black dress and grab the little handbag. And I want to go out for a nice evening because I'm feeling deprived right now. And he's not getting that.
Okay, yeah.
Dan.
Yeah. And it's like, Rachel had mentioned it as well. Like, I mean, that's kind of the story of both these girls is like, you know, they're being pushed around by their spouses, by the demon, being controlled by their family that we'll, you know, tap into in the later film. And, you know, and it's like Christy just like she really doesn't have a voice, you know, and it's like so I watch that. And so I still feel the empathy for her, even though she isn't fleshed out as much, you know, because and so maybe, you know, that might have been an intentional thing to kind of hammer that home that like, yeah, she just truly doesn't like we don't, you know, get to see, you know, we don't know what her hobbies are. We don't know what she does for work. Like, you know, none of that.
Yeah. And Devon, you kind of said it. I don't know what she does. Like, I don't know what she does either. Like, okay, well, she's a stay-at-home mom, except she has a full-time live-in housekeeper that stays there with her. So you figure Martine is the one who's cooking the meals, changing the diapers, cleaning the house. How does Christy fill her days? Like, what does she have to do? Like, I don't know. Like, you don't know of any hobbies she has. She doesn't seem to go anywhere. It feels like a very lonely existence.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe that is why, I mean, obviously she's the one with the baby, but like, you know, but why she is the first target for Toby, you know, between the sisters rather than Katie. So like maybe because like he was like, oh, like one, she has the baby already, and two, like she's gonna be the easier target to be able to manipulate.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it does feel like a metaphor for postpartum depression. Like you're seeing a lot of that like enacted out physically, but also it just feels like the depression that can often hit like after someone gives birth. And you know, Daniel's ignoring it. I mean, you see right when they come home with Hunter for the first time, like one of the first things Daniel says on camera is like, guess who had to change the first diaper? Like, it's a, you know, like, God forbid you have to take care of your helpless baby's needs. And Christy's like, well, guess who spent all night in labor pushing the baby through, like trying to compare the two things. One is much more difficult and taxing than the other. And it just,
that was my first of many eye rolls for Dan in the movie. Whenever that is like, one of the first things out of his mouth.
Yeah.
I don't see the postpartum thing maybe because, or I didn't think of that just because he's so much bigger by the point that you see him, but that is a really good point. They switch from brand new to a year old, but that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I just think, I guess if you're used to being subservient to everyone, or you learned as a child to be subservient to this demon, then that, like, how that plays out for the rest of your life. Yeah. And even for Katie too, because she chose a Dan-like man too, a Toby-like yep. man. How does yeah. that? And I don't think, I mean, I don't think they were, maybe they were thinking that deeply about it. But
yeah, and it's interesting. I feel like they made a conscious effort to soften the edges of the male character that appeared in the first movie. And yet this is still what you end up with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it does feel like they tried to soften the leading male up. And yet this is still what you get.
I don't know if they made him nicer. I just think they made him more subtle of an asshole.
Okay.
Like in the way that you like red flag versus like people talk about red flag versus yellow flag. I feel like Mike is, you're like, that guy is a dick. And like, obviously mm-hmm. Dan's a dick, but he's smiling when he does it. And sure. that makes it be like, I'm just joking, babe. Like,
yeah,
bought you this house. I'm just joking. That kind of insidious.
Where Meek is never joking. Like, Meek
is just a straight up dick. And you're like, at yeah. least thanks for being upfront about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the other thing too, watching this, is there's so many scenes of Christy isolated on camera with that security footage and the way the cameras are placed. It feels like the house is swallowing her up, especially when you see her positioned in that kitchen nook. Mm-hmm, and I'm thinking of the scene where, like, yeah, it's coming from overhead, and it's when the cabinet doors all open. And
the
she's
only
just...
scary part of that movie.
Okay.
That's the only part of that movie that I find scary.
Okay, interesting. None of it, nothing else.
No.
Fair
the
point.
One that does it.
Okay.
Well, I will say, since you said you didn't watch the unrated extended one, that's they took out a lot of scares, which I find fascinating. Like, a lot mm-hmm. of some of the more subtle scares are in the extended scenes. But yeah, that pots and pans is interesting. But Mike, you mentioned the cameras. We didn't really get to talk our why are we filming aspect for this one.
Let's do that.
And I think the film, I think the series does an interesting job of like varying the different ways that it's gonna be filmed and why certain characters, like, you know, in three and Ghost Dimension, we have actual filmmakers, so their footage and is different, and they like come up with more creative things. The first movie is just all one camera via Mika, and then this one, you guys have mentioned it. It's like, you know, these are security cameras, so it's like it kind of has this like more impartialness to the cameras, but it also feels a little bit more sterile, I suppose, because it mm-hmm. is just like this family being observed. I mean, we do still have a handheld camera because they had that presumably for when Hunter was born. So we do still have some handheld camera stuff versus the security footage. But again, I think that just like kind of speaks to the differences in the family, because like that, like this makes sense for, you know, somebody like Dan that's just like, oh yeah, I have the money to get this, all these different security cameras and everything. And it's like, it's still him doing something, but he's not doing anything about it. Like, he gets the cameras and stuff after, the first incident. But after that, he doesn't have to do anything. Like, you know, most of the time, if we are going handheld, it's through Allie a majority of the time. So it's like, I think it, the way that it presents itself in this one, it makes sense for the characters and for this mm-hmm. film.
100%. And Rachel, you said you didn't find the way this is shot scary. If anything, it took you out of it. And I'm fascinated by that. Like, what is it about the way the cameras are set up, or the setup of this, that doesn't work for you?
It is how they show what is on the cameras. You're going mm-hmm. this speeded through. You're like, oh, we're watching through the night. And then it stops. And then something happens almost every single time. Mm-hmm. So you're like watching it speed through. Had they just kept speeding through sometimes and showing things happened, or they showed the same, you know, like every night at noon, there's a check, and every night at three, there's a check, and you see it, sometimes stuff happens. It just is such a cue to me when the little screen starts running through a security camera and then it slows down. You're like, something's going to move. Something scary is going to happen.
So it doesn't trigger like any sort of Pavlovian response, like something.
No,
spooky.
It made me mad. Because mm-hmm. I'm like, you don't like.
I feel like they did it at least a little bit less in this one than they did in the first one. Because the definitely. First one, we definitely get a lot more of it. In this one, they will kind of check in, because one difference here in this one too is like the hauntings happen at all different times. Like it's not just in that 1 to 3 a.m. Window like it happens in the first one. So like we get a little bit more variety, but yeah, I totally get what you mean.
Yeah.
And that's why I think the kitchen scene was scary, because yeah, you're on the camera, but it's rolling through in normal times and then something big happens. Usually everything else, there's like, they're just, and even if they'd done it that way, but then had times where nothing happened to give you that sense of calm, that you're like, oh, we're just scrolling through this videotape. And then something happens sometimes, but it's just almost every single time. And it is definitely better in this one. There is more, but it just took, because you don't have the sound really. I know you have your thumpings and your groanings lightly, but you don't have a soundtrack to like all these cues to like mess with the tension and surprise you. I just feel like it's so straightforward handed to me on a plate that I'm like, I don't want this.
I get the opposite reaction. Because I think like you're getting the cue. And I said this when we talked about the first movie, what the first film did, and this one even more so because of the static, multiple static cameras, is an audience member, like you're actually participating in it more. You're not just getting pulled along for the ride. Like you are meant to almost do like a scavenger hunt, and you're meant to kind of like explore what you're seeing and ask like, where is the next thing going to come out from at this point? And you get some like subtle visual things. Like there's the scene in the nursery where the baby's mobile starts to spin on its own. And then just stops as soon as like Christy approaches the door again, like very small things like that. I think the use of like Abby the dog and letting her be kind of like making her more attuned that something is off in the house, and just her like staring at a wall that you can't see is like trippy to me. I'm like, okay, that is, it's more unnerving than the first movie. The first film, you get like the doors bang and like things fall down and Katie is pulled out of the bed and there are the footprints. This one, there are a lot more smaller, unnerving things that happen that are interspersed with the kind of larger, more haunting events. And I would say they work better than like the, sometimes they work better than the big money scares. Like the basement thing at the end, like that's ridiculous. Like that's just not shot well. And what works best in that is like when Hunter comes out, like in his little jorts at the end, like that just cracks me up. That's the only thing that really works there is like little baby John Cena in jorts coming out like nothing happened.
Yeah, the filmmaking in the third act is, yeah, it's pretty sloppy. It's like it's like really janky and choppy the way it like transitions into what they're doing in that one. And I saw someone made a note on it about like this is like one of the times where it's like, yeah, why are you filming Daniel doing the transference thing?
Yeah.
When they decide to do this too, Daniel even specifically is like talking about like, hey, we're gonna do this and we're never gonna talk about it. Okay, then why are you talking about it?
Film it
right now. And yeah, right. It'll film it then.
You could have just filmed it from like one of the other cameras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
where exactly. They aren't holding it, and then it makes sense. You see him doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think adding the security cameras too, we talked about how this is like making people more comfortable being surveyed in that first movie. Like we're kind of entering the time, like the iPhone is out now, where just right around the corner from things like Alexa coming out and like Amazon listening to like everything that we purchase. You know, we're not too far away from like websites sending us targeted ads based on our browsing history. You know, whatever we discuss, like you'll say like, I need to go get some sodas. And then you'll pop up a web browser and like 3 ads for Coca-Cola pop up. Like we're getting more and more comfortable with this idea of like every movement we make and everything we say being heard or seen somewhere. And this is a bit more insidious. I think the guy that sells them the cameras even says to Christy like, you won't be able to get away with anything. And he says this is a joke, but it's kind of gross. Like she's in her own home, like what would she be trying to get away with in her own home, dude? Like what are you insinuating there, bro?
I think you just meant like teenager stuff, like, oh, you're not gonna be able to sneak out, or you're not gonna be able to like drink, you know, okay, your parents' liquors. I don't think it was like anything like too weird.
Okay. Fair point. But like in their own home, they're being constantly, the difference between this and the first movie, Mika got to choose when they were filming. He had to pick up the camera, pick it up, turn it on, hit the record button, and they could pick and choose what they were recording. Here, they ask, like, is this always recording? And the answer is yes. Everything is recording all the time. They don't really have any say in what is and isn't going to be recorded. They're constantly surveyed. And that's a big difference. And that in and of itself, like outside of everything else going on in this movie, is kind of a scary thing.
Especially in 2010, like now, it's something I don't even think about because everybody has a Ring camera. Everyone has a doggy camera. I don't because fuck the government. I'm not letting anyone look inside my house or on my front porch. But everything, we're watched everywhere all the time. But then we weren't. So it just, it's another thing that places the movie we talked about, like Blair Witch. Yeah. Like it's something that would only be scary in 2010. And now in 2024, you're like, well, yeah, obviously it's always recording. Everything is always recording.
Yeah. I think it's way scarier that we've allowed. And I, as I say this, like I have a camera right behind me so we can like survey our bunny during the course of the day, right?
Well, that's
like
cute, I have though.
That, you know, it is. But then, like, big government can come down and be like, "What is your rabbit doing? He's a communist." Yeah. we definitely have a communist rabbit. It's really scary how we've not just allowed it to happen, but we don't even think about it. Like, it's just like it's part of our daily lives, and like, there's really not much we can do about it. It just sort of happened one day,
And we actively want it. I feel like we have made a world where we, that's what we want. Right. Because we're like, well, why wasn't there a camera? Why isn't this camera here? And you're like, because it's, I don't know, a fucking street. And maybe there shouldn't be a camera on it.
And if you say, man, that's a pretty weird thing to live through, the response you get back is, well, don't do crimes then, bro. And it's like, no, that's not the point. It's like, well, what are you worried about them seeing? Like, just don't do anything wrong. And it's like, well, who's going to determine that in the end? Like, you know, it's like, not, that's not really the point that we're making here.
Did y'all not read 1984? Can you not see what is about, what could possibly be happening here?
Yeah.
I like the way that you had mentioned, like, there's a choice, you know, in the first film of like when and why you're filming versus this one, it being like kind of, you know, out of their hands to a certain degree.
We kind of like went off track a bit. We wanted to do like, why are they still filming, which is something we're going to do throughout this series. Like when we did Saw, we did like the, like, it's a trap segment. And I put the Admiral Akbar, it's a trap sequence in way too late in the series, unfortunately. Otherwise, I think actually everybody would have quit the show. If I put it in the first movie, you guys all would have been quit by part three. It was like, fuck this. Why are they still filming? Which segments, you know, we see this in every found footage movie. It's like, dude, drop the camera and get out. What things happen in this movie where you're like, just drop the camera and go? Like, why are you still filming this? And for me, there were a couple of things. It's not really a why are you still filming moment, but the little toy train that comes out, that's a little nod to, like, I'm like, oh, Skinamarink with the little phone, except this time it's a toy train. Like, I thought that was kind of neat. But Allie filming her dad talking about doing crime, it's like, hey, what if we have your aunt possessed instead? Like, what if you put in the wrong tape at like Christmas holiday? Like, what if nothing happened and you're like, oh, let's put in the Hunter's first baby steps, and you put that tape in. And instead, it's like Dan going, let's transfer the demon to your Aunt Katie. Super awkward Christmas dinner. Super awkward. There's no recovering from that. There's no coming back from it. Do not film that. Do not film talking about doing a demon transference ritual to your sister-in-law. Ever. What about you, Devon? What jumped out in terms of what they should have not filmed?
I mean, I think that's really about the only one, because for me personally, whenever I'm watching a found footage, I'm usually not asking the question, why are you still filming? Because like, I'm more as far as like, why did you start filming to begin with? Because if you already started filming, then like, I'm not really good question why you're still filming, because that's what you were planning on doing. You're going to get everything on footage, you know, good or bad, you know? So like, I'm not as usually concerned with why are you still filming? It's just as long as it's set up on why you're filming to begin with, it's usually fine for me. But yeah, like definitely that scene, is like really the only one where I'm like, okay, like, yeah, why are you still filming at this point? Because like after the basement shenanigans, I think we should have been done with the camera by that point. Like, you know, if we're speaking realistically, like, especially like after, like it was like so rambunctious down there, like how'd the camera even survive? Like all that stuff happening. And from that point too, then we're also like kind of more, with the handheld than we are with the security cameras. But just by the nature of this one, it being a continuous filmed security cams, I don't really have too many qualms about like why they're still filming.
Yeah.
Same. I feel like that's the big one. Though there is one scene. It's when Katie and Christy are talking, and Katie's like, well, now weird things are happening.
Yeah, here. Yeah.
And I'm like, well, if she didn't, because that part I was like, well, and she's like, well, just don't talk about it. I was like, that fucking bitch, she knew what happened. And I was like, oh, wait, she doesn't. I forgot. Because in that moment, it makes it seem more like why would she be filming just that conversation with her sister by the pool? There's no baby, there's no kids, there's no fun family thing. So maybe that one for me.
Yeah. I think in the basement, I know they're like using the camera because it has like the light on it, and that's like the reason. But when the shit's going down, I notice like when Dan goes to comfort his son, and then something happens with the camera, and he's like, fuck the kid, and runs to the camera to make sure the camera is okay. So it's not so much a like, why are you filming moment, but it's like, oh no, my technology. Like, it's definitely. You know, if like your house is burning down, would you save your iPhone or your child? And you would hope that it would be, unless your kid is really shitty, you know, look, there are shitty kids. You hope it would be like, you know, you would save your kid and not the iPhone. But Dan is definitely the like goes to save his camera, and Hunter is just in his little jorts walking around in the basement, which is wicked unsafe because that basement is a hoarder's nest. Like that is like oh my god, like it is like sloppy as hell down there.
You have that big old house and you just cram a bunch of like dusty shit in the basement, come on.
Yeah, that basement was a horrendous mess.
Yeah, that was awful, not good whatsoever. So that was the other thing about this, so there wasn't as much, and part of that is like the cameras in this one are always filming. Right. It's you're getting a lot more of those like static cameras in this one. So stuff is just like kind of always on in here. Maybe the stencholata moment, like cameras don't belong in the bathroom. You know, you don't run in there with a camera into the men's or the bathroom. Nobody wants to see the stencholata. And for Allie, if you're going to sneak your boyfriend into your home when you're babysitting, you got to find a way to sneak him in to a room where there aren't cameras, not like in the living room, right on camera to play with a Ouija board. Like that shit will get you grounded usually.
So I suppose she knows her dad doesn't give a shit and isn't going to watch him. So she's like, yes, who cares? Yeah.
That's what I was thinking too, because I was like she's like babysitting, and then she's like, you know, having Brad like sneak in through the back door, and it's like, girl, you know you're on camera. But then I guess I was like, oh well, she's like, yeah, Dan's not gonna watch it, like whatever. So like, yeah, she just like doesn't care by that point, and then, you know, is bringing stuff. I was gonna ask, is this the Ouija board that Mika borrowed in the first one? It has to be, right? It
has to be. Good point. Really good point.
Like, oh, I know Allie has a Ouija board. Like, my niece has a Ouija board. I'll go borrow it from her rather than, and Mika probably knew that, had it in mind whenever, again, when he like said that line, like, I promise I won't buy a Ouija board. You know, so, which is, fascinating. And I really like, the little Ouija board prank for this one. I think that was, kind of funny.
Yeah.
I like the boyfriend. Like, he's not super annoying. he's not super helpful either, but like he's harmless at the end of the day. Like he's pretty harmless. And I think like he's not going to make a move on Allie that like she can't handle. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think she's in any danger around him whatsoever. So we talked a bit about Dan and what makes him kind of a prick. Can we talk about like, where do we feel that he turns into like a villain? Cause I think we kind of have come to the agreement, like he's worse than Mika. Like Mika is an asshole throughout, like from moment one without the jokiness. Whereas like, Dan actively harms people and makes decisions to harm people.
Well, he like Rachel said, like him having the veneer of being a nice guy or like playing it off, like almost makes even more sinister. The moment where like goes truly off board is when he fires Martine. You have Martine there, you hired her to like help take care of stuff, and like, you know, and just like his insistence on like never wanting to hear anybody out is super annoying throughout the film, especially again, you have camera. So it's like the point that he's just like, I don't want to watch the camera. I don't want to hear what your opinion is. Like, I'm just going off of what Dan sees with his two eyes. And like, that's like super annoying. And like the firing of Martine as well, like, you know, the way it went down, gave me that's like that casual racist dad, like kind of shit that I get from. Like, he's like, oh, I don't like you. Like, all she was doing was saging the house. That's it. Like, she didn't like, you know, she wasn't drawing out, you know, symbols or anything. She wasn't like, you know, doing other stuff. Like, she literally was saging the house and that's it. And he's like, I don't like you doing all of that. And like, and it's like, what do you mean by all of that, Dan? And then whenever, even later after she's fired and Allie calls him out on it, he was like, oh yeah, she was sacrificing goats out in the backyard. Yeah. It's like, bro, like, okay, like chill. And like Allie even says it. She's like, Martine was trying to help us, you know, she didn't feel safe and she wanted us to feel safe, you know, like, and spells it out, you know. So like him firing Martine, that's whenever I was like, oh, I'm so off board like with this guy. Not that wasn't to begin with though.
I feel like for me it was when he abandons his crying daughter to go to work. Not that he wasn't a total dick for firing Martine, but that is what I would expect from a guy like that, is to the minute the people who work for him no longer serve his perfect person, they're disposable. And I feel like everyone else values Martine and he doesn't. She's just someone who's hired. But to look your crying daughter in the eyes and task her with taking care of your wife and your baby, and you're just like, listen, I got to do this thing. You got to do it. I was just like, ah, fuck you, man. That's your kid.
Yeah. That was the same moment I put as to like, that's when he endangers his children. Because he's put like a minor in charge of looking after a one-year-old. His wife is clearly not in a good state of mind at that point and is clearly removing the supernatural aspect completely from this movie. She is a danger to herself. And there's no point in this movie that you ever see him call a doctor, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, an outside professional. He never consults anyone to say, he does for the dog, like right away, as soon as Abby is injured, like he's out the door at 1 o'clock in the morning to the emergency vet, which is like, Abby's a very good girl. Of course he should. But he shows more care to the German Shepherd than he does to his wife. And it's just him having a desire to sweep the problem away, that somebody else can deal with it. Like, he works for Burger King. Okay. There is no emergency. Like, there is no, like, the chicken fries aren't selling, I need to go to this board meeting. Like, I'm sorry. Like, there's nothing that can't be handled at a local level that you have to leave your wife, who is clearly in distress and clearly not able to function, where you have to run out the door. He is scared. And because he is scared, other people can deal with it. And you hear it. Like, he has that, give me the confidence of a mediocre white man. Like, we hear that expression a lot. He is that mediocre white man. Like, he is the guy hosting those meetings. You hear, like, anything that doesn't fit his narrow worldview, he's shutting the discussion down. I don't want to hear this crap. Stop talking about it. That's enough. And his default mode is to yell. When he's upset, He yells at people. He blames other. You mentioned the hot tub scene. You know, the scene where like Dan jumps into the hot tub and it's way, way, way too hot. He blames his daughter for like leaving it on and starts screaming at her.
Which he totally deserved, because like, who jumps into a hot tub? You don't like, if you would have been a normal person and stepped in with one foot, you wouldn't have burnt your balls. Yeah. Like, yeah, like, you deserve that.
Yeah. He's just like someone who just, his default is to scream at people when he's mad. And you're right. Like with Martine, he does her dirty.
And then he has the audacity to call her back when there's a scary ass ghost.
Yeah.
You're like, now you want her, now that you can't handle it.
Yeah, you should have, like, I don't know, asked her a few questions that night, you know, rather
than now,
like,
you want the burning sage. Okay, Dan.
Yeah. I do want to say Allie is somewhat complicit in Dan's decision at the end, because she is okay with him transferring the curse to someone, just not to Aunt Katie. So very much like her dad doesn't want, and I see you shaking your head, Devon, but hear me out. She is okay with that curse being transferred. Like, just give it to a stranger. The idea, like, I just don't have to see these people ever again. Curse them. And granted, she's like a 16-year-old girl. So like, that is, and it seems out of character. Like, well, compared to the person we've seen throughout the rest of the movie, it seems way out of character for her. But she ultimately just doesn't want her family member to be cursed. She doesn't care if somebody else suffers it.
I mean, it's, I feel like it's real. I mean, it's relatable. It's a relatable fear of like, yeah, I'm willing to do whatever is necessary to help. And I mean, she makes a good point. Yeah, like, I mean, yeah, like, because that's the way I would respond. Like, I couldn't willingly transfer it to like my uncle or something, or my cousin, like someone within the family. Hell no. Like, I couldn't get myself to do that. But like, I mean, if this was going on and I'm like, and there's a loophole that I can just pass it off to the neighbor I don't like, yeah, I'm okay. Gonna do it. But then there's also, but there's a moment though too, because she does, like, she at one point she does like kind of like say something back, and he you know, very much goes, we're doing this, it's I'm making this decision, yep. I'm the parent, and like my decision is final, like again doubling down on his me, I'm doing this, like, you know, I run things, like, kind of thing. And like, you know, again, like, it's like very, and it's very stern when he says it too. He's like I'm making the decision, and that is final, like, you know, not really giving her a chance to really be, you know, offer up any alternatives.
Yeah.
And if you go into looking at it, as we kind of discussed, that Dan is abusive in many ways, like a lot of times a child won't stand up to their abusive parent in a situation like that. And also, like, the whole transferring it to someone else, I feel like that's a horror movie trope that you see so many times that we're quick to jump on. And I think some of that is like a 16-year-old me totally would have transferred it to someone not related to me. Now I think maybe I would not, but I'd like to think that, but I'm also not getting bitten by shit in my basement.
Exactly.
So you can't really say what you would do. Yes.
Devon, you have to transfer the curse to one of the Pod and the Pendulum co-hosts in order to save the loved one. Which one?
Oh, man. If I was going to transfer it to any of our panel, unfortunately, it'd have to be you, Mike.
What the fuck, Devon?
I think I would transfer it to you. I mean,
I have a family, man.
Hey, you're the one steering this ship, you know, and if anybody's gonna take a demon, it's gotta be the captain.
I feel like I asked for that. I feel like I was hoisted by my own petard in that. All right. I appreciate your honesty.
Well, do you think you could transfer it to yourself? Like, do you think Dan, not that Dan ever would have, but do you think Dan could have transferred it to him?
Even if it was a possibility, I don't think he'd do it.
Never. But like, I would be more likely to do that. Mm-hmm, give it to me and I'll go die rather than someone I love.
Could you give it away like in a random Burger King bag? Like, what if he put the picture or something in a random Burger King bag, like to a really jerk ass customer, like, I didn't want pickles in my Whopper when you clearly did ask for extra pickles, or you didn't get enough extra pickles. So you're like, fuck this guy, demon curse.
Yeah.
That's probably the way I would go.
I think in another movie, which I'm glad they didn't do, I think another movie probably would have tried to transfer it to Abby. And I'm glad we didn't go that route because Abby's a good girl and she's fantastic. So I'm glad like that never came up in the discussion. Like, does it have to be transferred to a human? But like, Abby, I think that would happen like in a worse film.
Abby is the best girl. Yeah, Abby is the best girl. And I'm glad they don't kill the dog in this movie. I'm glad like she comes back. It's like just a seizure. You know, like Abby survives this movie. Let's talk about Martine. We've talked on her briefly. I think she's one of the highlights of the movie. I think the performance is absolutely fantastic. It's Vivis. Colombetti is who gives the performance here. She's really funny. She clear that she loves like Allie and loves the kids. And I think like the scene, she's like, you're going to see your boyfriend. He'll get handsy. It's to me hilarious. It's clear she wants to protect Hunter. It does fall into the trope of a non-white character who is also clearly not on the same socioeconomic and power level as the white family, having information and having to, it's like the magical Negro trope in some ways, where they have to sacrifice themselves in some ways or sacrifice a part of themselves in order to save like the white protagonist. And, you know, they're given to superstition or to religious fervor. So this film like does fall into that trap, doesn't it?
I'd say yes and no, because I mean, yes, that is exactly what is happening. We have a non-white person that is, you know, the nanny and everything. But I feel like at least in this, it makes sense within the characters again, like, you know, when in contrast to Dan, like, of course, Dan would, you know, that he would, you know, seek out a nanny that is, you know, that she doesn't even, you know, speak complete English. And I feel like that's even a part of like, you know, he to be like, oh, I can easily, you know, like she will do everything that we need her to do. And like, you know, without any retorts back because she can't. To some degree. So I feel like it's at least it makes sense within, again, like them, like, again, showing this portrait of the all American family, you know, and so I think it makes sense. And I also, at least they didn't kill her, you know, like she gets fired, she loses her job, that sucks. But yeah, at least they aren't going the route where it's like, oh, she's continuously trying to warn them and then she ends up being the one that gets hurt or something like that. So at least they didn't go that route either. Again, it's not a trope that I love, but I feel like at least in this, it makes sense within the family dynamic and like kind of portrait of Dan and his family that they're kind of making here.
As well as the location being Southern California, where you that have too. A lot of people who are immigrants, and you know, that community being right up against Mexico, you would be more likely to find Martine being able to work for you. I don't think it was 100% necessary, but also it's very 2010.
I think it'd still be 2024. Like, I think you would still see that. It might be handled like slightly differently, but I think like you would still see that today. I don't think that's something we've completely move past. And again, it's just like the way that she's portrayed, like you said, Devon, like she doesn't have complete grasp of the English language, and the way that like it is played, it's not necessarily played as humor at her expense, but her like not full grasp of the language is definitely played for a bit of humor overall. And she is someone like that is seen as separate from and apart from the family. And there are times like, surprise surprise, like Dan makes like her the butt of jokes, like, oh, like Martine left a stenchilada in the toilet, like that is you know, and there's like definitely a racial component to that joke as well when you play that one out. It's just something that like I just wanted to bring up, like that definitely comes up. What else do we have here though before we wrap things up?
Well, we got a baby to talk about.
Let's talk about the baby.
One, I will say, well, the best baby performances I've seen in a minute, because like the way that they have Hunter like kind of focusing in on something off camera a lot of the time, he'll be like looking in a direction. Like, I really think they did a great job with like him in some of these scenes to like kind of capture the tension of like, he clearly is like, you know, seeing something else, experiencing something. Or one of the extended scenes, or one of the scenes in the extended version, is the one where they're trying to feed him in the high chair and he's like super tired. And he like keeps rubbing his eyes, and it's like, that's like fascinating. Like, oh, poor Hunter's been up all night getting haunted by Toby. You know, it's like, I like, you know, what they were able to get out of this baby, and also for like certain tension scared sequences as well. Like the scene where he's like getting lifted out of the crib, which you can totally tell it's a doll, because when it's happening, the it's not moving at all as he's like getting lifted out of the crib. So it's totally a doll, but it's still like a creepy scene. And I remember like that happening, and then I was like, oh my god, he's gonna fall down the stairs, and somehow he magically gets down to the kitchen perfectly safe. I don't know, maybe Abby helped him or something. I think the way that they employ him is interesting, and then this also is the, you know, again, where we kind of get some more lore for the rest of the movies going later, because Allie is like looking up, and she's like, some people make, you know, deals with demons, and they have to give their firstborn male, and Hunter was the first boy born on Christy and Katie's side since the 30s. So again, like, you're planting some seeds for some nuggets for the lore later. I think his use for tension filled sequences is good, but like, again, like, they actually got like a baby that's like kind of acting in this. And I was very impressed.
The baby's got chops, that's for sure. I think one of the creepiest things was when he's just all of a sudden downstairs walking. Mm-hmm. That was one scene, like seeing him get pulled up out of the bed, you're like, okay. I mean, you know, I'm not thrilled about the general pulling of people scenes anymore, but like, him just then being downstairs, not getting downstairs, just walking by himself in the middle of the night, this little tiny dude who's a year old, that I think is scary, not only in like, there he appears, but like you said, fall down the stairs, we have that innate desire to protect children. That, yeah, you're like, oh my god, that baby's out of his crib, what if he sticks his finger in a light socket, or like chokes on a marble,
falls,
like,
in the pool.
All the things that are not even supernatural that come with it, mm-hmm, too. I was so bummed with the way they have his room set up. They have that big mirror, and I wish they had played with more movement in the mirror and things that were next to the crib that you couldn't see really. Every time we're in that room and she's standing there, there's this just like subtle little stuff behind her. Nothing's happening. And I'm like, I wish they would have done something that was only seen in the mirror. I was like, that would have been so rad. Yeah. You just like had something happening behind you that you only see over here in the dark corner of the sliding door. Or even like, I know maybe in the extended cut they do this, but there's so many more things when you have a kid that can move and be creepy, and I don't feel like they played those up. You have the toy, which is terrifying, but you've got strollers, you've got baby monitor, you have all these different things, and I feel like they did just sort of the same kind of scares, or not like cabinets bursting open, but you're like, you have all this rolly stuff, you have all this weird stuff.
What's the closest they come to that? Is that maybe when like the high chair falls over on its own?
Or the train. I do think the train, where it's just like moving, like, that's so creepy.
Yeah.
Little things so like that.
I do agree with you in what you said there, Rachel, too, in that like having the baby, like that instinct that we have right away, you want to protect the kid. Like, what if it gets outside and falls in the pool? Like, you know, that huge swimming pool is right there, and you can just think of like real world consequences of the baby like drowning in there. Having like the two of the objects of the haunting being like Hunter the baby and Abby the dog, as an audience, like, whether or not you love or hate this movie, you're going to be more sympathetic to those characters than say Mika in the first movie, where by like minute 45 you're like, oh man, I can't wait till he gets killed.
Yeah, you're like, kill actively, him now.
Yeah, like, how about we just destroy him now, and then the rest of the movie is like Katie and the demon high-fiving, like,
yeah,
and because even beating together.
Yeah, because even in this, you're just like, even though we want Dan to die, but we're like, also, but like, but then who's gonna take care of Hunter? Ah, like, you know, so it's like, you know, yeah, it does kind of give a little bit of that layer. Rachel had mentioned the leg pull scene. What's everybody's favorite scare?
The cabinet.
Cabinets.
The cabinet scene is super fun. That if you check, I think it's on YouTube still. You can see like the behind the scenes where they had like everything rigged up to like fishing lines to do it practically, and they kind of did the thing where Christie's actress knew what was going to happen, but she didn't know when. So they let her just like play it out and then like did it at a random time. So like her reaction and that is like genuine. Yeah. I like that. I think the leg pull in this one is better than in the first one. Yeah. Like it's a little bit more extended. We kind of see her like have to like try to go back and like it's, you know, and then she's like her body's like in the air, like as she's like on like the edge of the steps. I think the pulling scene in this one is really fun.
Rachel, you're not a fan of that. You're not a fan of the leg pull.
I'm not. And I think I didn't look at it this deeply when I watched it before, but watching them back to back for this, that's, I think, what did it. Because I'm like, you just pulled Katie at the end of the last movie down the stairs by her leg. Even, or out of the room, I guess she's not down the stairs, but down the hallway. Had you pulled her by her arm, had you pulled her by her hair, by her sweatshirt, I was like, what should have been the coolest scene, because it is different and it's definitely better than the first, the way she like kind of rises up and has to crawl back up the stairs. But I'm like, you couldn't have come up with something other than the one big motion from the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if they're not back to back, I wouldn't have felt that way. But preparing for this, I was like, I just watched that. Yeah, it's better, but like, not, I feel like you could have knocked her over the banister and have her, instead of falling, have her held by the demon up and then dragged. Ooh. Just something to change it that would have given me more of like, ooh, you're doing something new. And just like, that's, you did that in the last one.
Yeah. I'll tell you what got a gasp in our theater and what still gets me. And I'm surprised you said like, this is where you said like the cabinet scare is like the only good scare. When at the end of the movie, like when Dan's on the sofa and he's like looking around and Katie just shows up in like the bloody wife beater shirt, like that got a gasp at our theater.
I was like, yes, kill Dan, let's fucking do it. I was stoked.
So you're like ready to go. Like, this is your Hogan versus Andre moment. You're like, truly, let's do
it. You cursed your sister. Mm-hmm. And like, even though Christie didn't have anything to do, you married some jackass who cursed your sister. I'm like, yeah, go in there and kill him.
Yeah.
Had Allie been killed, I would have been bummed.
Yeah.
But I'm like, once she shows up, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
He's gonna get her revenge.
Yeah, I love the framing of it. Like, yeah, she's just there. Like, we don't hear the door open. We don't like see her walk into frame. She's literally just like there at one point, and then like 20 seconds later, snaps his neck with the quickness. That one is super fun.
I'm trying to figure out the timeline of that though, because it says like right before it happens, like Miko was killed October 8th. But he was killed October 8th, but he was killed at like 3:30 in the morning. Like, it happens at when the clock changes over. So does that mean that like Katie waited all day in her home and then made her way to the house? And then it's the fall, and it really would have been 2 days later that she killed, not like that evening. It would have been like a full almost 44 hours later that she kills her, you know, sister and brother-in-law, which is the Friday the 13th part two. How does Jason get to Alice's house with his mother's severed head? Does he take a Greyhound bus? Like,
yeah,
does anyone notice this guy with a bag head and a severed head under his arm? Like, what's going on here? So I can't make the timeline quite work. And I think they may have made a mistake.
So that's what I was talking about earlier when I said like it was a little bit clunky. It does say that it is October 9th whenever she goes to go kill.
To kill them.
Yes. I mean, and.
But he died on the 8th is what they say. It would make more sense if he died on the 9th in the early morning.
Well, I guess we're in plot. I guess we're inferring that Katie walked. We don't know how close they live together. Even though if Tokyo Nights was canon, possessed Katie was apparently driving a car. But in this,
I don't think she was driving. I think she was hit by the car walking outside the house.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Sorry. So I was just reading off the plot, but yeah, so I'm going to just assume that, Kate possessed Katie had to walk and it maybe took her some time.
Yeah. That would be like a long time to walk outside in sunny Southern California
and covered shirt. In
like a bloodstained wife beater.
I don't know. Maybe Toby had some stops to make on the way. You know, it's his first time out of the house. He need to go hit up one of the taco stands and get some good grub on the way. Maybe, who knows?
Do you think Toby recognizes currency like we do?
No. Probably took the tacos and then killed the taco drivers too. Mm. Probably.
Bastard. That is a scene that did get a big reaction. And poor Allie, like, you get the title card at the end and you're like happy that Allie lives, but like, what a scene to walk into.
Yeah, I was bummed that we didn't get that. I that is one of my biggest complaints. I was just,
you
like,
want really? Her tears?
Well, I want to see the reaction. Like, I think it was a weird cop out because, again, it was like the transition, it was like kind of funky because at one point you know, we see when Katie goes to Chrissy's after everything had been cleared up and there's like, oh yeah, no, everything's been good and blah, blah, blah. And then that's whenever, and Katie like mentions, you know, things were starting to happen. So yeah, there's chunkiness in the way that they get to that, the way that they get to the end, but then also they don't even explain, you know, like Allie going on this apparent school trip. I never even mentioned it. She's just not there for the finale. So like, yeah, I wish they either A, like made more attention to, you know, sending her off, or B, I would have liked her to kind of see the follow-up of like whenever she like gets back. Like, you know, like, you know, we just see the security cameras, nothing is going on, everything's empty, and then you see her walk in and she's like checking the rooms and calling for people and nobody's like answering until she finds their bodies. I think that could have been a cool scene.
Definitely.
Really, really fucking morbid, man. Really morbid. I just think it's so sad. I mean, like, what a thing to walk into. Like, your father is killed, your stepmother is killed, your baby brother is gone, and your favorite aunt did it. And you have nowhere to go after that. Like, you're 15, 16. Where are you going after that? Like, also, I would like to have seen is a scene.
Hopefully not grandma's.
Hopefully, yeah. Good point. I would like to have seen when the cops find the footage of her filming her and dad discussing the demon transfers and her having to explain
that. I mean, hey, she can't get arrested. There's no laws against demon transferring that we know that of. So, I mean, they can't really book her for anything.
That's a technicality right there. Well, do we have anything else before we end things for today?
I really like the recurring use of the sound design, like that that there isn't like a specific noise. It's just like a rumbling that you like kind of hear over stuff, and it stays over the entire credits. And if you watch the entire credits at the end, you can hear Hunter crying.
Hmm.
Yeah. So,
well, the kid crying must have made you happy.
Oh, of course. Of course it is.
Course, can't believe you wanted her to walk in to find her parents' dead bodies. You're like, that would have been a happy ending.
Is that really the most morbid thing we've said here on this podcast
before? It is not.
No, I'm with him though. Worse. That would have been a good ending.
I think that imagining it is, we can imagine it probably better than they could pull it off. But yeah, it would have been pretty terrible.
Just would have been a nice little acting scene to give Allie that, you know, that final girl, you know, cherry on top.
Even that just is her opening the door and walking in and making a snack with Dan's body in the living room. And she's just looking around and is there. And then it cuts and explains, so you don't even see her see the body, but she's just in there, you know, having something, and he's crumpled.
She sneaks the boyfriend in and her and the boyfriend are like making out on the table and the dad. Yeah, jeez.
That's the morbidest thing.
Yeah. That is the thing about being a final girl, is you don't focus on the word final a lot. Like, everyone's dead. Basically, all your friends are dead. Your family is gone and you're the last person standing. Like, that is a lot to recover from. So on that note, I think we can put this one to bed. I think we're done.
Yeah.
Paranormal Activity 2. What a movie. What a sequel. And we'll be back next week to talk about Paranormal Activity 3 Dream Warriors.
Hey, and we won't have a shitty dad to talk about. We get a good stepdaddy to talk about this time.
Now, will that help him, though? Will that help him survive a Paranormal Activity? Will being a good man, a good person, help you survive one of these movies if you're male? Spoiler alert, no. He gets like the worst death of anybody. Oh,
can't wait.
He gets like folded like a Weird Al accordion. It's brutal. Just unfucking believable. But before we go, Rachel,
yes,
let us know about your photography, where our listeners can find you, what projects you have coming up.
You can find me on Patreon under my full name, or I'm on Twitter under Indie Smut Peddler. Come talk to me. I love to talk about movies and really anything. I just love to talk. So thanks for having me on. I appreciate you guys.
And what is your Patreon, and what do listeners, what do patrons get if they subscribe to your Patreon page?
So I'm a photographer. I've been shooting mostly nude, but also I do horror movie shoots every October. So they get access to my full catalog of photos and videos of about 8 years at this point.
Wow.
Nice. I mail people Polaroids or prints, different options. So
excellent. And that site is?
That's patreon.com/Rachel Schwabach. Or if you search for me, because Patreon kind of sucks in this way, you can't search for me on Patreon because I do nude work. So if you Google my name and Patreon, that's the way to get to my page.
Excellent. Excellent. Devon, Spectre Cinema Club, what are we doing? It's March Madness, right?
It is March.
So is that Hoosiers? Are we doing like Gene Hackman and Hoosiers? Like no horror this month?
No, I wish. There's not many sports horrors when you think about it. Not too many of them. I have a few ideas to change that. But instead, we are celebrating Women's History Month over there for March. So we are covering all films directed by women. So we've done American Psycho, Near Dark, and then we got A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night coming up. As well. So we got some fun stuff over there. New episodes every Tuesday. We also have a Patreon now. So if you want some bonus goodies, patreon.com/SpectreCinema. And you can find me at all the usual places at _DaddyDisco.
Excellent. And listeners, you can go to our page, podinthependulum.com, where all of our back episodes are. We're approaching 250 episodes. We're going to turn 5 May of this year, like early May. So we are approaching 250 episodes as we've been like near weekly for throughout the run. So that's kind of amazing, I would say. You can follow us on Twitter at Pod and Penned. Follow me over on Letterboxd at Mike Jump Change. Oh, we have an Instagram at Pod and Pendulum as well. We do have a Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/podandthependulum, where we have like a ton of bonus content up. I do have to do some makeup work. Like February, I got very ill, did not get to record a bonus show. So we're going to try to throw an extra bonus episode up this month as well, along with some other goodies at patreon.com/podandthependulum. Please make sure that you are rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us wherever you get your podcast. Just got like a nice 5-star review and a few kind words from a listener in Great Britain, which we really appreciate that. Thank you so much. I think they left it on my birthday too, which was really nice of them. So nice little gift there, but make sure you're going ahead and doing that. And yeah, we'll be back next week with Paranormal Activity 3, which I think is the high point of the series. I think most people would say that that is like the best one in the franchise. And then it kind of, let's see, it all goes downhill from there. So excellent. But we get 3 pretty solid films. And Rachel, we'd love to have you back on. So let's definitely keep in touch and get you back on real soon. Listeners, we'll be back next week. Take care.